Alan Blackman, Professor of Chemistry, School of Science, Auckland University of Technology. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. It's a beauty in Auckland, I've got to say.
That's great. Now, the ladybug, the common ladybug. Mm-hmm. Oh, no, I'm confusing the ladybug with the ladybird.
Yes, indeed.
Well, that's a bad start. I'm going to have to Google ladybug now and have a look at the picture. Okay, tell me about the mealybug.
Right.
Well, it's a mealybug ladybird.
Indeed, the mealybug ladybird. So there's four main players in this story, so we've got to keep sort of track of them, so let's list them. So we're going to talk about the mealybug ladybird. Now, that comes from Australia. We're going to talk about the cochineal bug, which comes from the Americas, and which came originally from the Americas on the back of the prickly pear plant, which is also from the Americas as well. And the cochineal bug, for those of you who know your stuff, that's where you get cochineal food colouring from, that nice sort of red colour. And we're going to talk about ants as well. And we're going to go to Spain to talk all about all of these major players.
So, off you go then.
Here we go. Right, let's begin. Okay, so a bunch of workers in Spain and Switzerland, they've studied this mealybug ladybird. And this mealybug ladybird lives on prickly pear cacti in Spain. Right. Also on the prickly pear cacti are a bunch of ants. And the ants like to try and eat the ladybirds. And so what happens when ants attack the ladybirds is that the ladybirds emit a bright red fluid, which is full of a thing called carminic acid. And that carminic acid is actually poisonous, and it deters the ants. Okay, so this is just a classic example of, I guess, chemical warfare on an insect scale. And there's nothing unusual about that. There's lots of insects out there that can sort of produce toxins and everything that's going to deter predators. Okay, but this is a little bit different. So what is different with this is that the ladybird itself doesn't manufacture carminic acid itself. Okay, and that's kind of weird. Again, it's not without precedent because we've got some frogs and stuff like that that can do this. They can eat toxins and then they can use those toxins to deter predators. Okay, so what's happening now is that the ladybird, what's different about this is that the ladybird itself lives on an invasive species in Spain. As I said before, so the ladybird comes from Australia, the prickly pear cactus comes from the Americas, and the cochineal bugs, which we haven't entered into yet, also comes from the Americas. Now, what does the ladybird feed on? It feeds on these cochineal bugs. Okay, now, the ants, which we also haven't mentioned, the ants, they don't like the ladybirds because they're busy excreting these things, and they also don't like the cochineal bugs, okay? So they steer clear of the cochineal bugs precisely because they also have this carminic acid as well. But what do the ladybirds feed on? They feed on the cochineal bugs, okay? And that's where they get their carminic acid, their chemical defense weapon from. That's where they get it from. And now this is the weird point, is that there's no sort of evolutionary connection between any of these things, okay? We're talking about introduced species that have come from Australia, come from the Americas, and gone to Spain, okay? So while there are examples of, you know, these things like frogs that have co-evolved with other insects or plants or whatever that they can get their toxins from, this appears to be the first recorded example where you've got a species that is now ingesting a toxin that it can then use for defense from a species with which they've got no evolutionary history. And that to me is kind of cool. How's that for a story?
That's a pretty amazing story. What's the takeout from this? Is it just how clever nature is when we just let it get on and do its thing?
Oh, look, nature's just amazing. I mean, they're, you know, miles ahead of us, really. And obviously there's got to be some sort of evolutionary thing going on there, you would imagine. That, you know, this just didn't happen just, you know, straight out of the box or whatever. That something's got to be going on, that these ladybirds presumably are just sort of slowly evolving or have slowly evolved to be able to actually do this.
All right, what else are you going to surprise us with today?
Okay.
Handwriting, this doesn't surprise me at all.
Oh, thank you.
It's a good thing.
Thank
Don't be giving
Catherine.
It up anytime soon.
Thank you. I, oh, No, well, whenever I come to RNZ, I've always got my handwritten notes with me, and they get commented on so often. Oh, what lovely handwriting. It's not really, it's not beautiful handwriting, but it's just handwriting, and it seems to be so rare these days. And I will sit and, I'll stand in my lectures. I'm busy lecturing students and stuff like that. And lots of them, you see, they're just sitting there. They are just sort of listening. Or they've got their screens open and their computers or whatever, but they're not, or very few of them are actually writing stuff down.
Go on, get to the good stuff. You know how much deeper learning is when you handwrite. It's interesting, I don't want to get into the handwriting versus using a laptop scenario, but the actual physicality and what the brain has to do to make that pen work.
Yep.
First, it's got to process the information, then it's got to transmit information through the hands in a physical act onto the page.
Yep.
What's going on inside the brain that makes that so potent?
Well, that's the thing. So there's a bunch of workers in Norway who started studying this particular question. Is handwriting better for the brain than typing? Do you remember things better if you write them down than if you type them? And the answer seems to be yes. And the way that they studied this was that they wired up a bunch of volunteers with all of these things on their brain, okay? So, you know, literally wired them all up with all these sensors. And they were looking at brain activity when a word would come up on the screen and the volunteers would either handwrite it down or they would type it. They monitored the brain activity. What they found was, as you said, with the handwriting, there's a big, big increase in the brain activity and in areas associated with learning and memory, okay? And that only happened with the handwriting, not with the typewriting. And they also found increased links between the outer part of the brain that's to do with motion and sensing and the central parts of the brain which have to do with memory. And the quote from the paper is, on the whole, brain activity is, quote, much, much higher for handwriting. So it appears, if you want to remember something, you write it down and then write it down again and then write it down again. And look, that worked for me at university. That's what I did. I just,
The typing's more automated. I mean, it's faster and that's great, but you won't necessarily be recording what you're typing. It's when you go back with a highlighter pen and put highlighters all over it. I know from handwriting questions, I scroll all over things while I'm doing interviews, right?
Yes, yep.
It also makes it easier to find things because that act, so if, you know, you could have all this print sitting around you, but the little scrawl that you've scratched in your dreadful handwriting, you will find because you have the memory of physically putting it there and physically
Absolutely.
Doing it.
And you'd have to scroll up and down on a screen which only shows you part of the
document. Oh, my Lord, don't even start me on that.
Look, we're agreeing on this, Catherine. Goodness.
Completely agreeing on it. My worry is that that handwriting will disappear.
And I completely agree with that as well. And that at university, you find that students really have trouble handwriting exams.
They can't handwrite the whole shebang
and
take notes. And boring as it was to sit and handwrite and take notes, that was what got it into your memory, into your head.
Amen.
My worry if we lose it because we say it has no purpose as a skill is that we're losing just what we're talking about.
Okay, is the Minister of Education listening out there? Please do something.
Yeah. People hate daylight saving. I don't know why.
Yeah, neither
I love it. But anyway, I don't have to get up and milk cows in the morning.
No.
Why do people hate it?
Well, that's a really good question. Well, they seem to particularly hate it in the States. So there's sort of big discussions around this in the States at the moment. And, you know, there's been, I believe, a bill that's been passed by Senate, but it's being held up in the House or something like that, where people want to go to daylight saving all year round, okay? And so the people who want this appear to be the politicians. The people who don't want it, surprise, surprise, appear to be the scientists.
I don't want it all year round either.
No.
Because then it would be darker in the mornings.
Yes, very, very, very much so.
Yeah, no. I like a bit of both.
And so the study, so these people did a study of, you know, it doesn't really apply in New Zealand because we only span one time zone, but in a place like the US, where you can live right on the border of time zones. So what they found is that people who lived in the east of a time zone had much, much fewer or many, many fewer car accidents than people who lived on the west hand side of a time zone. And basically the explanation was, right, so the sun is coming up later on the west hand, on the west of the time zone. And you're also, you're getting longer evenings. And so what supposedly is going on there is that people are going to bed later, but they still have to get up at the same time. And when it's dark, they're
not
tired.
Good. Okay.
Then,
It's only 1 hour. Again, I don't have to get up and milk cows. And
but some people get really affected. Yeah, but people get really affected by it. And again, there's studies out there that say that, yep, you get lots more accidents in those crossover weeks, just after the crossover for daylight saving, which for us occurs twice a year. So, but how they do it in China, for goodness sake, because that spans one time zone. It actually spans five time zones, but it's the same time in the whole country. So
Alan,
you get up in Xinjiang.
Thank you so much, Alan Blackman.